Warning, the following audio transmission is based on theory and is intended for entertainment purposes only. It's Doomsday and its affiliates will not be held liable for anything your dumbass does. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome everybody to It's Doomsday Podcast. Today is January 5th, 2024. Time is 0930 in the morning, and sitting down with me today is Kent. And Kent, you're a professional beekeeper from West Kentucky. We don't want to confuse that, right?
Right.
So what's the difference between a professional beekeeper and a non-professional beekeeper?
Well, a professional beekeeper is willing to spend a lot more money.
Okay.
For one thing, no, professional, being a professional beekeeper just means that you're willing to go the extra mile, that you're willing to educate yourself into what it takes to actually help bees to survive and educate yourself and learn how to make your bees pay their own way.
Okay.
Which is that hobbyist, the definition of a hobby is something you spend money on and it takes up your time.
For fun.
That's a hobby. Yeah, you spend money, you expect to spend money on a hobby and it takes up your time. A professional beekeeper, whatever your profession of, any money that you spend on it has to be justified. And the bees have to pay their own way. So a professional learns how to make that happen.
So I have a bunch of different questions. So the first one, I guess, and I've been asking everybody this question, what is the biggest threat to the bees as of today?
The biggest threat? Well, the biggest threat is the same thing that it's always been. It's an abstract. The biggest threat's the unknown.
Okay.
Because we're actually pretty good at killing varroa mites, but it's the viruses that they vector into the hive and the bacterial diseases that they vector, that they bring into the hive. Once that disease or virus is there, the bees themselves become the vector. And you can have no varroa mites and still have a high virus load or have a high bacterial disease load, even with no varroa mites, once they vectored it into the hive. So the biggest threat are the things that we can't see.
Okay.
It's the viruses. There's a lot of viruses that aren't even identified that have very, very little visible symptoms. There's only a few viruses that have a visible symptom. So you never know you've got it until your hive is empty. And in the end, you don't really understand what caused your hive to go empty, but that in itself is the only symptom of that particular virus.
Okay.
And that's the biggest threat, the things we can't see.
So I'm under the impression, and this is what I've been told, that bees will not go to a stranger hive. Like, they know their hive, that's the one they go back to.
Usually.
But my question with that is, if a bee is being a vector and it has one of these viruses and it's pollinating something that another neighboring hive is pollinating, can they transfer it from
Yes, they can.
So it can move from hive to hive to hive.
It can move from hive to hive to hive just because an infected bee took nectar from a bloom.
Okay.
Or took pollen from a bloom. And an uninfected bee lit there directly after and took nectar from the virus transfers. Through the body of the bee. When they're taking nectar out, the virus is going back and forth. Just like when a varroa mite is feeding on a honeybee, the virus is going back and forth. Or the bacterial disease is going back. There's a transfer, like being bit by a rabid animal. That virus transfers, and it can transfer in nectar or pollen. But bees do drift. A honeybee that's working a nectar source, they're going to stop close to their hive, but not necessarily in their hive. And if they have resources with them, if they have nectar that they can share with the guard bees, they're welcomed in. And there's your transfer. That bee becomes a member of that colony at that point. And the nectar that it has shared, that it shares with the other bees, is the beginning of the vector into the hive of a disease. Drones are welcome everywhere, because drones are no threat. Drones have no stinger. They don't even have large enough mandibles to be able to rob a hive, and they're welcome everywhere. So there's a big drift with drones. And drones don't just drift from a hive to a neighboring hive. They drift from a hive to another hive that's a quarter mile away. So,
oh, wow.
So they can be a major vector of diseases.
So you've sparked a new question in my head now. So how far will a bee travel away from the hive? Because if a drone's going, you said like what, about a mile?
Drones usually don't travel more than a half mile.
More than a half mile.
Away from the hive. And they're not out foraging. They're out looking for a queen to mate with, going to a drone congregation area. But when they come back, they may come back to the hive that they were raised in, or they may come back to another hive. This drone may go home with another drone to their hive. And they're welcome, because drones are not a threat. Just like young bees are not a threat. You know, they're welcome. Nurse bees are welcome everywhere, because they're not a threat to the hive they're being transferred into. But they'll go a half mile usually. Worker bees, the simple answer is they'll go as far as they have to get resources. Normally, you know, the rule of thumb is roughly 2 miles, two-mile radius from the hive. There's somewhere upwards of 8,000 acres covered in the average range of one hive. But they travel 2 mile radius all around the hive. If there's something closer, they won't travel that far. They may not travel but a quarter mile or a half mile. But bees very seldom work what is right directly in front of the hive. They usually fly over it and go to something a little bit farther away. So normally honeybees are foraging anywhere from an eighth of a mile to a mile away from the hive. If there's nothing any closer, they'll go 2 miles. If there's nothing at 2 miles, they'll go until they find something.
That's pretty wild to think about when you think this little critter is going that far when most people won't walk 2 miles.
Right.
You know?
I'm not walking 2 miles.
Or further if you need to.
Right.
So with these diseases that you're talking about, is it known, like you're saying, you know, the unknown, but are they all known, or are there diseases that are still coming out that are being discovered, and well, how are people treating for these?
Well, the viruses the viruses are the most popular boogeyman for honeybees these days. That's what everything's blamed on, and probably deservedly. But to identify a virus, you have to have something to compare it to. So if a virus has not been seen before in a honeybee, you have nothing to compare it to. You just know that it's different from the ones that you've looked at before. So the really smart people that are researching these things, they know that there's a lot of viruses out there. More than 2 dozen, maybe 3 dozen, maybe more, because they've found viruses that are different from everything else. They don't even name them. They don't have anything to compare them to. They just know that it's there, and they have no idea what the effect of that virus would be on the honeybees. They just know it is a virus and that it's in the bees.
Now, is the winter beneficial to kill off these viruses? When the freeze comes, does it kind of put a stop to some of these things?
The viruses live within the bee.
Okay.
Most viruses are not very persistent once the bee is dead. If the virus is living inside the bee and the bee dies, then the virus, the host dies, the pest dies. Some are persistent, but most viruses are not persistent. But in the winter, you have a winter cluster, the bees are still alive, the virus is still alive within the bees. Some viruses will kill bees, will kill the host. Some viruses will not kill the host, but they will just cause the host to not act in the way that it should, you know, not forage properly or not feed properly, or you know, there's different ways that these viruses affect bees, and nobody is really that certain exactly which virus is causing bees or why a hive dwindles. And maybe it's a virus, maybe it's bacterial, maybe it's a poor queen, but if it's a virus, who knows which one and who knows what to do with it. And there's nothing really that you can do to counter viruses. So the viruses are always there within the physical body of the bee as long as the bee's alive, and for a while after the bee's dead. So in the winter does not kill the viruses within the bees. It would kill the virus if it was outside the bee, but it's not.
Does the winter kill the bacteria that could be in there?
If it's inside the bee, no.
No, okay.
Anything that's inside that cluster of bees is going to stay alive.
Okay.
Over the winter, because the bee is its actual host. The reason winter kills bacteria or kills viruses is because the virus is without a host, or the bacteria is without a host, and then it dies in the winter.
Okay. So in your realm of professional beekeeping, I'm assuming this is something you see a lot. You know, obviously you see a lot of this. When you're traveling to different, you go visit other beekeepers, I'm assuming.
I do.
Okay.
A lot.
And when people are discovering this is the problem they're having, that it was a virus or a bacteria, what is their countermeasure for, say, the next year to help prevent this? Like, what are the steps you go through to help kind of prevent it?
Well, the number one thing is keep as low of a mite count as you possibly can.
Okay.
Do everything you can to have a zero or one mite count. That's zero to one mites per 300 bees. So 1/3 to 1% is preferable, and that helps. It won't stop it, but that helps, and it will lessen the spread, because then the bees themselves are the only vector, and you don't have mites that are increasing that vector. And you were talking about viruses dying in cold weather. We think that, and it's true, that viruses die in cold weather because in cold weather, you count on cold weather killing the cold virus or killing a flu virus, but it don't kill that flu virus within us,
right?
Or the cold virus within us. That's how you have to look at the honeybee colony. It don't kill the viruses within the cluster, but it will kill it. Like if you sneeze, the virus that exits your body will die in cold weather, but
if you sneeze on someone else, they're taking it home.
It has a host. All of a sudden, right. It has a host, and it survives. Same way with bees.
So what, when the bees are asleep in the winter, are they maintaining a certain body temperature? Like, is that hive maintain a temperature?
They do. The cluster will stay somewhere around 75 degrees or so.
Oh, wow.
Within that cluster. But the entire box does not stay 75 degrees. That 75 degrees is just within the cluster. And there's bees that their purpose is creating heat. They put their heads in the cell, like that, and thin membrane of wax between them, and work their flight muscles, like us running in place, and it creates heat. Then you have bees that are insulating in between the frames, and they hold the heat in that frame. So it makes each frame its own heat sink, and that's what keeps that cluster warm. Sooner or later, these heater bees run out of fuel. So they come out and go to feed, and the insulator bees become heater bees, and they trade places. It don't take energy to be an insulator. It takes energy to create heat. And if you open a hive up in the middle of the winter in cold weather, and it looks like it's just kind of working, that's what you're seeing. You're seeing this exchange of bees that goes on all the time in the winter, that there's an exchange of bees from being the heat producers to being the to feeding and being the insulators. So they keep it about 75 degrees until the queen produces some brood. As soon as brood is produced, that small area brood will stay in the low 90s, 92, 93 degrees. The rest of the cluster might be 75 on the outside of the box or on the perimeter of that cluster. It may be 50, but that cluster is going to be 75 degrees unless it's got brood. Then in that patch of brood, it'll be 92, 93 degrees, maybe 94.
So Ken, how long have you been beekeeping? Because like, I mean, it's, you're very knowledgeable in all this. I mean, I get the professionalism in this.
About 35 years.
Wow. Okay.
That's... It took me about 5 years to realize that if I was going to keep doing this, I didn't have enough money to replace the bees
right
every year. And I'd better learn how to keep them alive and how to make more bees.
So what made you get into beekeeping in the first place?
Well, it was something that made people look at you like you were crazy.
Okay.
You know, that's... And I had the, I just came out of a lifestyle where that people would look at you like you were crazy. And I'd straightened up.
I think they ought to start the fire for you.
Well, they should, but...
I could just take a nap there. We used to go camping.
Yeah.
When my kids were growing up, we'd always have a fire, and I would always get in the lawn chair.
Yeah. That's fun. Poking the fire.
Yeah.
But, so my family raised, I grew up on a farm, still live on the same farm. My family homesteaded the farm in 1823.
Oh, wow.
So I still live on that farm. And they raised hogs, they raised corn, they raised tobacco. And I grew up in that economy. And tobacco was on the way out. It was plain to see that the government-based system, pool system, was going to be a thing of the past. So we sold our tobacco base and needed to replace the income from the tobacco with a small acreage crop that would yield a similar income. So we started, my wife and I started raising produce. And part of the crop, one crop that we raised was yellow squash. We sold it to a brokerage in St. Louis. And yellow squash has to have a pollinator because it has a male bloom and a female bloom. Any cucurbit, cucumbers, squash, pumpkins, melons, they all have to have an insect pollinator or some pollinator that moves pollen from the male bloom to the female bloom, or they won't produce fruit.
Right.
And I didn't realize that.
I've seen videos online of people hand pollinating these things.
You can.
Yeah.
And people that are plant breeders, that's what they do. They hand pollinate so they can make sure that it's only the pollen from this plant that pollinates this other plant or this bloom, pollinating another bloom. But I needed bees. And I knew a man that in my neighborhood that had some bees, and he had a peach orchard. And we had an interaction because of a dairy farm that I worked on. And I asked him one month, he was an inspector that came to the dairy farm every month, and I asked him if he had any bees. And, well, actually, he needed barn room for his tobacco. I didn't have tobacco anymore. So I traded him barn room where he could store his tobacco for a hive of bees. And that fixed my problem with the yellow squash.
Seemed like a good trade at the time.
Yeah, it did. Yeah, it did. And that hive of bees, that was the nastiest hive of bees that I had. It was 30 years before I had a hive that was as mean as that one again. But I stuck with it, and that was almost like an attractant to me, thinking that I might die this time. You know,
okay.
Because they were intimidating. That hive was intimidating. Years later, this same man, he told me, he said, I knew you were going to make a beekeeper. And I said, well, how'd you know that? And he said, that hive of bees that I gave you, that was the worst hive I ever had on my farm. He said, I never was so glad as when that hive left my farm.
So he got a better end out of that deal.
He hated that hive because they hated him. And then they transferred that to me. They hated me too. He said, I knew that if you stayed in beekeeping after having that hive, that you were going to be a beekeeper.
That's a good story. So, I like
but,
that.
But, I mean, that's my beekeeping started because I needed pollination for yellow squash. Wasn't thinking about the honey. Within a year, people were coming to the house wanting honey, and we just didn't have it. I mean, one hive is only going to make so much. So before the first year was out, we went from one hive to three hives because people found out we had a hive, didn't even have honey yet. They were coming to the house, driving 15 miles from town to come to the house to buy honey, along with tomatoes and sweet corn and other things. But we went from one to three hives. The second year, we had 17.
Oh, wow.
And the third year, we had 51.
How many do you have now?
About 1,200.
Holy crap.
But when we got 51 hives, there wasn't anything much that was killing bees at that time. And then we were introduced to some things that kill bees. And I realized that I need to learn how to make bees more than I need to learn how to make honey. Honey became an incidental product, and bees became the primary product. So I learned how to raise bees. We started selling bees at that point, and it became a self-sustaining business at that point. That was about 6 years into beekeeping. So, you know, we've had ups and downs. We've had to fight American foul brood before. And you never really truly defeat American foul brood because it's out there somewhere, just waiting, you know. But we've had that fight before, and we came out ahead. And we've had almost every disease, had to deal with almost every disease and pest that you would have with honeybees, and had to learn how to manage it. That's the professional part. You learn how to manage the hives, even in with pressure from diseases and pests, and learn how to manage around that and make the bees pay their way.
Okay, so not necessarily a political question, but kind of political. You have 1,200 hives now.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any kind of, you know, kickback or problems or pressure with like the EPA or local municipalities or city officials or anything having that many bees? Or are they just pretty much, it's agriculture, let it go?
Well, we're very careful to place our bees where that they won't be, there won't be any questions about things like that. We rent a warehouse in South Mississippi, and we rent bee yards down there. And the bee yards are away from people's, they're away from civilization, with the exception of one. And the people want that one there.
Okay.
And so, even though they might get stung occasionally, they get honey from it, and they think it's kind of cool having a bee yard right there in their neighborhood. It's not a big bee yard. It's a 24, 28 hive, something like that. But it's enough. I mean, when you've got 28 hives that each of them has 50 to 60,000 bees in it in the middle of the summer, and it's hot weather and sticky and the bees are on the outside of the hive, salesmen don't come to the door.
That's, you know, good.
When they're sitting out. But that's the only yard that we have that is in the proximity of any amount of people. Of course, I mean, where I live, we have 300 hives. In the middle of the summer, we'll have 300 hives at any given time. And they're within 200 yards of several, a half dozen houses and families. And nobody ever has a problem with them because they're bees. They do the bee thing, and they don't bother people. Nobody has a saltwater swimming pool either.
Right.
So makes a big difference. We're careful about where we put the bees. But, yeah, there could be an issue. And with the EPA, the only issues we have with EPA is the regulation on treatments that EPA has, and we have to keep ourselves updated on what is the legal allowance for certain treatments for mites and bacterial diseases, and make sure that we stay within the kind of within the riverbanks.
Okay.
On that, there's a proposal to change that regulation from EPA to FDA, and if that happens, it's going to be a major change in all of beekeeping.
I feel like it would be a worse change.
It's way worse.
Yeah.
It's a lot worse. And
last time I checked, the FDA wasn't doing too many good things.
Well, when they begin regulating what can be put in a beehive, that means that you're going to have an applicator's license just to put a sugar patty on.
Hmm.
And the sugar patty's got to be an approved sugar patty, which makes everything's going to be more expensive to use. But that's not happened yet. The thing is, though, it seems like that when governmental agencies start talking about maybe we might do this, they've already got it in mind. They're going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
They don't start talking about it until it's already in the pipeline. So they're just gauging how much pushback there's going to be. And beekeepers can't give much pushback. There's not enough of us. So it will probably happen at some point. When it does, everything's going to get way more expensive to use in a hive, and you're going to have a license to use it to be legal. So it'll make all of us outlaws.
Yeah. I mean, in my mind, I think you have so many small independent guys doing this, it would be something almost impossible to regulate. But when you get to a larger operation, I feel like that's when the eyeballs would start coming toward you.
Yeah.
So, Kent, we're almost out of time. I got something I want you to try.
All right.
I have a really weird diet, okay, and I need more nutrients in my diet. So I discovered this stuff. I want you to try this while we're recording here. This is Spartan bee bread.
All right.
And I figured what better thing to do than have actual beekeepers try this stuff.
No peanuts in it, is it?
No peanuts.
Okay.
It is actual bee bread with black currants, sea buckthorn, and apples and cinnamon for flavoring. And it is like packed full of omegas and all these different vitamins, and I take this to kind of supplement nutrients.
Well, if I can get into it, I'll try it.
Yeah, it's got a really good, tough packaging.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I have a knife if you don't.
I'm from Kentucky. What do you think? I got a knife.
So everybody's reaction to this has been a little bit different.
Have they all survived?
Yes, they're all still walking. Well, I haven't seen most of them today, but...
It smells a little like dog food.
Tastes a little better, though.
That means you've tasted dog food.
Yes, I have.
It's not bad. Tastes like dried raisins or dried cranberries, dried figs. Kind of reminds me, kind of figgy.
Kind of figgy?
Uh-huh.
I like figs. So the story is this.
I'd eat that even if you weren't forcing me to.
You like it?
It's okay. I'm not going to go to a restaurant and say, do you have any of that bee bread?
Yeah, you got any of that bee bread over there? I'd like to order the bee bread as an appetizer.
Yeah. No, that ain't happening. Now, if you deep fried it, maybe.
Maybe. I'll tell you what, I eat three of those a day. And when I first started taking, like I said, I did it as a nutritional supplement. After about a week and a half, I had like this boundless kind of energy. Like I didn't want to sit still. I wanted to get up. I wanted to walk around. I just couldn't sit there. Not like anxiety, shaky energy, but just wanted...
Not a caffeine rush.
Yeah, not a caffeine rush, but wanted to move. After about 2 weeks, that leveled off. And then something crazy happened, which was like extreme mental clarity.
Hmm.
And I don't know if it's the omegas in there or what, but I'm forming sentences better. I'm not tripping over words. Things are just happening more clearly.
So where do you get this?
You can get this online. We get this through the StampedeNetwork.com, and we have a discount code for that. I'm not promoting it while I'm here, but I wanted people to try it. So if
I'm just saying, this is good enough people to buy it.
And it's supposed to be made by one family beekeeping company in the States. I've been looking to do more research into them. And I didn't want to dig too far into it because I didn't want to know, but how wild would it be if the creator of that was walking around here somewhere,
right,
sat down, and I'm like, here, try your own product.
Well, if he didn't like it, that would be a problem.
Oh, yeah, it would be. So, Kent, we're about to be out of here. I want to thank you for coming on the show. And before we go, is there any hard-hitting, super awesome advice you can give to anybody out there that's thinking about getting into beekeeping?
Yeah, get into it with your eyes open. Know what you're getting into. Visit or join a local beekeeping association. Talk to people. Most beekeepers are very willing to share with you, to share knowledge, just to share stories. And so you'll have a better idea of what you're getting into. You won't be like me in that one hive that I thought, man, these things could probably kill you. You know, you won't be so intimidated. You'll actually have people that you can go to their place and stand there while they're working through a hive. And you'll know what you're getting, you'll know what you're going into. And that starts with being involved with a beekeeping organization or other beekeepers. You don't have to have a mentor, but it helps if you just have somebody to kind of walk you through the whole thing. And somebody you can cry on the shoulders when your bees die.
Right.
I tell people that there's two absolutes, only two absolutes with beekeeping. Everything else has too many variables to account for. Number one, you are going to get stung. Prepare yourself for it. You are going to get stung. You can lessen the likelihood of it, but you can't escape it. Number two, your bees are going to die. In the age that we live in now, it is really difficult to have a hive in your backyard and keep that same hive alive and going for more than 3 to 4 years. Most of the time, within a year and a half to 2 years, half your hives will be gone. I mean, you'll either lose them to swarming, especially when you first start. Get comfortable with that. Start with more than one, less than five hives, and one of those hives, treat it like that it's a cadaver. You know, that's your hive that you dedicate to science. You don't donate it to science. Go through that hive as often as you want to go into it. It's probably not going to thrive, may not even survive. The rest of them, set them up, make sure they have queen right, make sure they have a laying queen, they have plenty of food, and they're disease and pest free as possible for the rest of your hives. But that one, read everything you can about bees and try to find it in that hive. Learn with that one. And if it dies, it dies. If it don't, it served its purpose. It has taught you what a hive is supposed to look like when it's healthy or when it's not healthy. You learn from that. And after that, it becomes a process of being stubborn. Don't quit. If you want to be a beekeeper, you have to make up your mind you're not going to quit.
Great advice, Ken. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yep.
All right.
Emergency action message. At approximately 1 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, NORA is tracking 15 ICBM nuclear missiles inbound to the following cities: Orlando, Miami, Pittsburgh, Dover, Newark, Richland, Philadelphia, New York City, Baltimore, Los Angeles, Las Vegas, Boston, Seattle, Detroit. This is an extremely deadly situation. Stay tuned, the next emergency message will be a presidential address.